yad e she kli benali dashichin ne tori chi she bashichin akadine dashinela shima e beitha chi aro beitha chi dashichi dithichin de nasha aro kinflene shihuan. My name is Kli Benali. Currently, I live in Flagstaff, Arizona, originally from Black Mesa, and I'm an organizer with Talahoan Info Shop and indigenousaction.org. The history of police and policing in the so-called United States is important to understand in its initial inception as enforcement of the interests, the economics of slavery and the interests of slave owners against black folks. So it's established in anti-blackness to uphold the economy of slavery. But you have to also recognize that policing and the enforcement of settler colonial, settler invader laws were really a practice of many entities, not just like formalized law enforcement entities, but military entities or just individual invaders or settlers who would come in and enforce the perceived laws, whether it's doctrine of discovery, manifest destiny, and other laws that were established that were anti-indigenous, anti-black, to establish settler colonialism and resource colonialism as well. So the history actually of the slave patrols just goes back to the 1700s, but we see the dynamic of policing and enforcement of these invaders' laws as something that's established in the initial waves, even before the establishment of the so-called U.S. With the invasions of the Arawak lands in the so-called Caribbean with Columbus and his violent, murderous forces. And you see that what they were motivated by certainly was established with the doctrine of discovery, the papal bulls, sort of giving license and establishing this impetus to go out and to conquer these lands and claim them and really, you know, wage genocide. So, you know, the violence of settler colonialism has been enacted by many agents that represent not only the state but this sort of idea or idealism of colonialism, which is heavily rooted in capitalism. So in the so-called Southwest, we have one of the highest populations of indigenous folks. These so-called border towns, and I don't like to use the terminology border towns because the city of Flagstaff, for example, is occupied stolen lands. We have 13 indigenous nations that hold holy the San Francisco Peaks, which this settlement, this invading settlement, was established right at the base of. And so currently we're addressing a crisis of racial profiling and targeted policing of indigenous communities where in a town of about 70,000 people, we have on average 6 to 8,000 arrests per year. And if we look at the annual police reports, half of those arrests are indigenous people, even though we only make up 10% of the population. So that amounts to one in every two native people facing risk of arrest, regardless of age, in this community. And that statistic is actually worse in some of the other outlying so-called border towns like Winslow, where L'Oreal Sinigini was gunned down by Austin Shipley, a white police officer, for allegedly shoplifting. And those statistics are also present in other so-called border towns like Gallup, Farmington as well. So in the outlying areas around the reservation boundaries, these internment camp, concentration camp boundaries, we have these extraordinary examples of targeted policing of indigenous folks. And the implications are that we continue to face the reality that these laws and the ways that these laws are enforced were never set up to serve indigenous people. Historically in Flagstaff, indigenous folks have been invisibilized, we've been disposed of, we've been made to be discarded by white supremacist settler society because we don't benefit this society, and our existence is a constant reminder of the history and the blood that is on the hands of the establishment of this colony, and that is perpetuated through the violence against our sacred sites and the ongoing violence against women as well, with missing and murdered indigenous women, which law enforcement play a critical role in perpetuating as well. So it's important to recognize that those statistics are one thing, but the reality and the implications are that, you know, our relatives on the street, unsheltered, or just being a brown or even a black person here in this society, is that there's an antagonistic relationship that targets us because of that disposability, because of the relationship that we have had historically and how it's rooted in settler colonialism, and the violence that is exacted is the violence perpetuated through these agencies. Important to recognize the geopolitics of resource colonialism, and resource colonialism, basically differentiating that between settler colonialism. The settler colonialism is where the invading forces will dispossess indigenous folks, indigenous populations, in dispossession can look like genocide, for the purpose of settling those lands. Resource colonialism isn't necessarily complete dispossession. It could be dominating, controlling, subjugating those populations to extract whatever resources, but the indigenous population still maintaining a position on those lands. And the settler colonial society outside of that benefiting and prospering. So in terms of resource extraction, resource colonialism, what we face is the police are always at the front line protecting those corporate interests or private interests that are waging violence against Mother Earth and inflicting trauma through whether it's coal mining, whether it's uranium mining, whether it's fracking for natural gas, whether it's gold, whether it's oil extraction, or whether it's even recreational commodification of the natural environment, which is a form of extractive violence against the land. And that's exhibited through places like Arizona Snowbowl Ski Area, operating on the Holy San Francisco Peaks here. They're a ski area that has been resisted for many generations because of the sanctity of this mountain. It's holy to 13 indigenous nations. It's a critical environmental site as well. But the ski area has expanded, and they have most controversially been permitted and sanctioned by the U.S. Forest Service, who maintains that land as public land, and by the city of Flagstaff, who maintains a contract to sell 180 million gallons of treated sewage to spray on that mountain for the purposes of snowmaking. Because in the face of climate change, these industries insanely want to supplement the natural weather that we don't have by making snow out of sewage pumped through a 14.8 mile pipeline uphill. And so we've been fighting this, but what we see, of course, is that the courts, we fought this in the courts, we fought this administratively, we fought this in various forms, and the courts have constantly failed us because these laws were never set up to serve indigenous interests. These laws are established, they're premised, or they're predicated on the severing of indigenous people's ties to the land, and that in and of itself is a form of direct genocide, but it's also ongoing cultural genocide, because these sacred sites that are extraordinarily important for our survival as indigenous people, our existence as indigenous people, these laws aren't set up to serve that. And so what We see, of course, is through enforcing those laws, the police are at the front line protecting those private interests, protecting those economic interests, protecting those corporations when we stand up for our cultural survival, when we stand up for our existence, and we dare to fight back when these courts and these systems have failed us. And so, myself, I've gone to jail many times over this. I've faced trespassing charges for simply praying up on this holy site. I faced disorderly conduct charges for chaining myself to bulldozers, along with many of my friends and accomplices in this struggle to protect this sacred mountain. But every step of the way, we faced the threat of armed thugs that are protecting state interests or federal interests or these economic interests above those of our survival as indigenous people. And so this is the dynamic that we face. And this is not an exception. This is an example of the reality that it's a microcosm of the reality that we face anytime we stand up to protect our Mother Earth on our terms as indigenous people, when we want to practice basically our ways of life, just praying and protect those ways of life for our future generations and honor the work, the voices, the spirit of our ancestors. So this has happened at Mount Graham, which is a sacred site in southern so-called Arizona. This has happened at South Mountain. This has happened in Mauna Kea. This has happened in Standing Rock at Lake Oahe. This has happened at so many other sacred places where they really are the physio-spiritual front line in the fight for our survival, our existence, not just culturally, but physically as indigenous people. The police are always there at the front line enforcing these laws, these invaders' laws, and perpetuating violence against our people on a long-term basis for future generations. And this is also, the violence of the land is violence against people, because the land holds trauma. Our identity, our way of life, our existence is directly intertwined and deeply connected to the land. We can't separate it. There's no dichotomy between spirit and nature for our way of life as indigenous people. It's one and the same. And these court systems, these laws, the police who enforce those laws don't understand it on those terms. They're only serving their interests, and those interests were never designed to serve us. There's a lot of folks who say honor the treaties, but they've never actually read the treaties. If you look at the treaties, there's a lot of most treaties that I read, particularly the Treaty of 1868 for Diné folks or Navajo people in this area, very much was established to control indigenous populations, first and foremost to settle and cease warfare. These treaties are on the terms of duress of indigenous folks. Guns were to the heads of appointed leaders, in many cases these puppets that were designated, and sometimes it was just those who stood up and fought on behalf of the peoples and the land. But in any event, the reality is that if you look at the terms of those treaties, they were set up to police indigenous folks and to control who was on the res, who was off the res, allow folks to be on or off the res, and restrict that access as well. And so they set up police agents on the res based upon our treaty and enforce that. And so the terms of the treaties were really terms that weren't established to further and empower indigenous autonomy, is actually to subjugate and control it. So from that point on, you have to understand that's deeply part of the historical relationship. And it was initially a military relationship and engagement and settlement. And then we have to look at the result of that and how that plays out on reservations today, because the constitutions that tribes have adopted, the structures of governments, mirror the U.S. government. And that's by no accident. The Navajo Nation Tribal Council was set up in 1923 for the sole purpose of extracting resources from our lands. And so any arrangement politically, you have to understand then, was occurring on those terms. So the interests, of course, were not to benefit the indigenous people, but to benefit those the settler or the resource the relationship of resource colonialism. And so the enforcement happens on those terms. The enforcement is established within a constitution that the Navajo Nation has adopted based on that. The enforcement is established in most, I think the best example is when we look at the so-called Navajo-Hopi land dispute that was established in 1974 by the U.S. Congress in a law called PL 93-531, which is the so-called Navajo-Hopi Relocation Act, which divided our people, separated Navajo-Hopi land, and forced the removal of more than 20,000 Diné folks from our ancestral homelands. But today, there are still families, elders, who are resisting this forced relocation. It's been a 40-plus year battle where they have effectively resisted all the U.S. power, the U.S. might, all their policing forces, which have been exacted upon them. Elders have been brutalized. Elders have been arrested for ceremonies. Ceremonies have been desecrated up in this area, but they continue to resist. They continue to stand up against that. And it's interesting because we see multiple jurisdictions sometimes come out and address the enforcement of these laws. Sometimes it is tribal police. Sometimes the tribal police don't have the capacity to address these issues. So if there's like a foreigner out who's a non-tribal member who commits an act of violence on the reservation, sometimes those the law enforcement agents won't actually enforce the laws against them. And this is where missing and murdered indigenous women is a critical issue that needs to be addressed when it comes down to policing as well, because many times people know that they can commit a law on a reservation and then they won't be prosecuted for that. Not to say that that would result in protection for indigenous women, but recognize that they see vulnerability and they capitalize or they exploit that. And that kind of violence is precipitated by the system that wasn't obviously set up to protect indigenous women, protect indigenous lands, protect indigenous people at all. So that's part of the failure and clear example and demonstration of that. And so what we see is if there's a federal crime that's committed, or a felony or an extreme crime committed on the reservations, then it becomes a federal offense and it is treated differently. And so sometimes there's a question of how the jurisdictions work together. I know on the Navajo Nation, they have compacts, they have memorandums of agreements and understandings as well. But you have to understand first and foremost that reservations in indigenous nations, the tribal governments, are puppet governments. They were propped up and established as proxy entities to settler colonial powers. And so sovereignty has never really been defined. What we have are domestic dependent nations that ultimately, at the end of the day, the laws are enforced and upheld in the interests of that settler colonial entity as a whole. So if we look at the history of tribal gaming, for example, where some tribes were like, hey, we want to set up our own casinos, or we want to set up our hemp farm, we want to set up something independent that maybe the state laws prohibit or the federal laws prohibit, but because we're sovereign nations, we should be able to do so. Or we can even look at traditional fishing and the fishing rights and those fights in the so-called Pacific Northwest. We can look at the tobacco wars in Mohawk territory as well in some of these areas. And we see what happens is when indigenous nations want to enact and uphold and practice their self-determination, we see state entities, we see federal entities unleash the state violence against them. And so this is part of the dynamic, part of the challenges that we face. It plays out in different ways in a range of different reservation communities. We have more in the so-called U.S. we have more than 565 so-called federally recognized indigenous nations, and it's complex. I think there's a lot of interesting ways that the concept of decolonization is being applied today. And it's, for the most part, a buzzword that it's like one of those words that you say over and over again until it loses meaning. If we look at the terms of decolonization in Africa, you know, where Fanon was exploring and analyzing and actually part of those movements, or you look at the terms of decolonization in other places, it means war. And that's the reality. So, you know, in terms of who's going to enforce and protect settler colonial interests, you know, this is conflict. And we have casualties within that. You know, we have to look at this so-called criminal justice system that exists in the U.S. being statistically globally the largest incarcerator in the world of folks. You know, we can see why we have Red Fawn. We can see why we have Leonard Peltier's. We can see why we have so many other unnamed indigenous folks who have been kidnapped, who are political prisoners that are held because they are indigenous, because they have answered the call to protect Mother Earth, or because they are living and being who they are. You can't decolonize the police. You can't decolonize policing. You can't decolonize the prison system. It must be abolished if we're talking about an actual decolonial or anti-colonial approach to addressing the ultimate systems of oppression that the police represent. So it's intrinsic upon our approaches if we claim any sense of decolonial or restoration of the indigenous and assertion of indigenous ways of being with Mother Earth in being free and with our integrity in our existence, then yeah, there's no way we can reconcile the existence of policing, the police state, and the carceral state. Ideas to restore those ways and understandings, and we still have our elders, we still have our relationship with our natural environment and the spirit world on that basis that informs how we work together. You know, that question is answered very subjectively, dependent upon the indigenous practices. For our folks, we have peacemaking, which even today is actually formally integrated in the judicial system on Dene Pekea or the Navajo Nation. But it's rooted in a traditional cultural practice of transformative and restorative justice. You know, when we address these issues, we address accountability and responsibility. We address, you know, what ways can we transform the transgressors, but also what ways can we restore those that have been harmed? What kind of restoration is needed? And so these are basic practices that are integral with our ways of being, but are extraordinarily challenging to maintain when our cultures are so fragmented and fractured and influenced by such toxic social practices as policing and imprisonment. And so this idea of punitive action is something that I think has really poisoned our approaches, but something that we can also heal from. So, you know, it's hard to imagine a future where our people would benefit from what we currently see as a trajectory of society based on policing and incarceration. You know, if we look at the statistics and they could keep growing, that means we have no future in policing and incarceration. So we have to really critically look at the tools that we have and the ways of being, the ways of working with each other. And that means restoring our cultural practices. And it's not something that we need to imagine. It's not something that we need to go to. too far back on. It's something that's existed and still isn't intact in many communities. It could be through our matriarchal societies and ensuring that they're intact, and restoring that power in ensuring that the practices that go with accountability and responsibility, transformation and restoration occur within that as well. And so those frameworks exist. It's just a question of reconnecting with them. You know, it's not something that's linear. It's something that's cycle or secular, and something that we can reconnect to that cycle. I mean, we can't reform the police, just like we can't decolonize the police. There's a lot of calls for police accountability, but we don't want a kinder, gentler form of oppression. We want to be free. And so that means abolishing police. It means abolishing the carceral state. It means ensuring that we develop dual power and alternative systems at the same time, or restore those alternative systems for justice in our communities that are actually just, not based on that aren't just solely punitive or not separate from the terms that would be established and informed culturally as well. You know, our traditional cultural knowledge is very powerful and can provide the framework for healing in our communities. We just have to empower that and reconnect to that. And so I think another issue that we come up against is that, especially indigenous communities, there's a lot of co-optation of Black Lives Matters, like with the hashtag Native Lives Matter. You know, we can be better that. We don't need to co-opt a unique, powerful, historical moment and movement, but, you know, we can proclaim Native Justice Now. It's there's a website, nativejusticenow.org, that is addressing that co-optation and recognizing that we have a unique opportunity as Indigenous people to basically join in the rallying cry. Because when we say Native Lives Matters or Native Justice Now and Black Lives Matters, ultimately what we're saying is the same thing, that we want to abolish the white supremacist police state, and we want justice for our people. We don't want our people to, you know, be murdered anymore in the streets by agents of the state. And so this is really, the rallying calls need to be honored. We have our own songs, just as the Black communities have their own songs, and we don't need to perpetuate anti-Blackness by co-opting those slogans, because it's more than just a hashtag. It's more than a slogan. It's a moment. It's a movement. And there's deep history, and there's a lot of meaning that is put into that. And so I think what we need to do is, of course, always go beyond these hierarchies of oppression, recognize that we have a common enemy, and fight against that. And that's what the Black Panthers and AIM did in their inception. You know, AIM, the American Indian Movement, was initially established as Cop Watch. So there's a deep history of recognizing the violence of the state, recognizing the need not just for accountability, but to go beyond these calls for reform. Like, you know, we don't want the police to be equipped with body cameras as a form of accountability, because we know that doesn't work. The police in Winslow, when they murdered L'Oreal Sinogini, Diné woman and mother, in cold blood, put multiple bullets in her body. They had a body camera on, you know, so creating this false sense of accountability, it's really just an extension of surveillance and PR relations for law enforcement, when the reality is that we have existed with each other in accountable and just ways before policing, and we can continue to do that when we abolish police and when they're gone. Understand what their laws are, and a lot of folks frame that as knowing your rights, but their laws have been imposed on us, just like when we're going to pray on our sacred lands and then we're charged for trespassing. The reality is that, you know, we're never trespassing in our sacred lands, and so of course that argument doesn't really hold up in court. I know, because I've tried to make it, but in the court of the colonizers, we know what their terms are, we know what the limitations of our assertions could potentially be, but it's important to empower ourselves to understand their laws so we can assert them in any interaction. And I don't necessarily believe in you know, nonviolent direct action de-escalation tactics. Sometimes we need to strategically escalate and assert and confront, but also obviously be smart about it, understanding that, you know, when you're going to a demonstration, you don't want to carry dangerous objects or, you know, certain substances that might catch you more charges. Understand what how this system operates, study it, understand how the court system operates, the so-called justice system operates, and that way you demystify that. Many of our folks already understand it because we've been survivors of it. It can be very frightening, can be challenging. There can be a lot of fear, and it can be very disempowering when we go to these actions, when we go through demonstrations and different express different forms of resistance, and we become targeted. Because in many cases, people become disempowered because they become isolated. So I think we need to have more concrete forms of culturally based jail solidarity, more ways of supporting those inside from the out, to make sure that folks, either if they're doing long-term time or if they're doing even just going through, you know, misdemeanor charges, that there is that support and connection to culture and community through the whole process. So that way, when they come out, it's not just a linear process and they're spit back, and then they are subjected to more capitalist and colonial violence, but they're reconnected to community, reconnected to culture, to the culture, there is an understanding of ways that we can continue to grow our resistance towards liberation. And so, you know, understanding their laws, preparing ourselves, because if this is a battle, this is really war, we have to engage on those terms and be prepared for the certain sacrifices that come to that. But we don't need to discard, we don't need to dispose, we don't need to isolate, but support, stand, and be smart about what we do. Not every action needs to be strategic, but if we think things through and understand how their system operates, what their laws are, what the limitations are, then we can engage more tactically and hopefully more effectively. I mean, we have to also understand that we're operating in a new political environment, and we have not only state or federal entities that we have to go up against, but we also have private security forces that are basically paramilitary forces that enforce the interests of corporations, and in many cases interface very clearly with law enforcement entities of the state. And so those forces can be a lot more dangerous. So we have to recognize those forces like Tiger Swan up in Standing Rock. We have to recognize those private security forces where people have trained, you know, as paramilitaries, or maybe they come from military backgrounds and they get jobs at these private security forces protecting corporate interests, like what we saw at Standing Rock, or we see the extreme escalation of the militarization of law enforcement entities, where they're bringing out militarized weapons. And so we have to be prepared for that and understanding the new political environment that we're operating in. Since 2006, we've seen with the escalation of the Green Scare and the targeting of environmental advocates as eco-terrorists, our people have always been treated that way. But escalation of terrorism enhancement charges is something that we have to consider now in relation to the resistance work that we're doing. So being smart about understanding our law, being smart about understanding the ways that the state operates, the new ways that the state operates, what its capabilities are, and thinking through our actions and being as responsible as possible, and not succumbing to the fear, not, you know, recognizing that our culture is stronger is more powerful than that, and will carry us forward, even if some of our relatives are facing a serious time. But we got to be there with them, because as long as someone is incarcerated, then none of us are free.